is Protective Life Insurance against B&K Enterprises. Ms. Bachhuber?
May it please the Court, my name is Rachel Bachhuber. I'm one of the attorneys who represent Megan Hansen, who is the named beneficiary of the life insurance policy that is the subject of this lawsuit and this appeal. Protective Life Insurance filed an interpleader action and joined Megan Hansen and B&K Enterprises, LLC, as defendants in anticipation of a dispute regarding the beneficiary of the life insurance policy that insured the life of Richard McDonald.
If the controlling standard is what should have happened, is it a problem for you that the change of beneficiary form should have been signed by an officer other than the insured and only McDonald signed the form?
I don't necessarily believe that the controlling standard would be what should have happened, because what did happen is that Kathleen Brighton, who's the vice president of the Division of Policyholder Services, who's above the employee who originally processed the change of ownership form, stated that the change of ownership form that was originally submitted by Michael Culligan that transferred the policy to Richard McDonald was processed in error and would be approved.
But actually, though, I think you have a problem with what did happen in the final analysis. This change of ownership form is sent in, and it's rejected, maybe for a good reason, maybe for a bad reason. Let's just assume for a bad reason, as you've said. So it's returned to B&K, and so no change of ownership at that moment is recorded on the books of the life insurance company. Then it goes back to Mr. Culligan on February 19, 2008, who, for reasons that I don't know, sits on it. I don't know whether he had second thoughts about whether he wanted to do it or he was busy or whatever. But he never sends it back to Protective. And so Protective, in fact, never makes on the company's books a change of ownership. And then, of course, unfortunately, on the 23rd of February or so, the suicide happens. And so as of the time of death, the owner of the policy is B&K still.
The owner of the policy is B&K Enterprises, Inc., a non-existent corporation.
The owner of the policy is B&K, and I don't think it helps you to think that it's B&K, Inc., because it's not Mr. McDonald. And the policy would have had to have been owned by Mr. McDonald at the time he executes the change of beneficiary form for the change of beneficiary to be effective. Inc. or Enterprises, LLC, or whatever you want to call it.
At the present time, everybody involved knows, obviously, that the owner of the policy is B&K, LLC. And based on that, the vice president of the Policyholder Services Division has stated that that transfer of ownership form should be processed and approved or does satisfy the requirements.
But it wasn't. That's the thing. And then you have the problem on changing the owner. The policy language is actually somewhat broader than what these people were testifying. It just says to make a change, and this is the provision about change of ownership, the company must receive a written request, and then the key words, satisfactory to the company at its home office. So they weren't satisfied when they get the first thing. As I say, let's assume that's by mistake. They thought it was a corporation. It wasn't. Meantime, they'd gotten this kind of strange thing from Mr. McDonald, which is completely wrong under any view of how this was supposed to happen. And Mr. Culligan never sends back anything. He doesn't send back a letter saying we're an LLC, my signature is enough. He doesn't send back a letter signed by two people. He doesn't do anything. And so nothing has changed as far as the company's books are concerned with respect to the owner of the policy as of the time of death. Obviously, at that point, it's too late.
But the fact of the matter is that the transfer of ownership document itself is a binding contract to transfer the ownership.
And it didn't do it.
But the contract still stands today. So why can't we turn that contract in? I'm sorry.
B&K's contract.
It's B&K and Richard McDonald. B&K contracted with Richard McDonald.
Not Richard McDonald anymore. He's dead.
But he was still a party to the contract. And Megan Hansen, as the intended beneficiary of this life insurance policy, has standing to enforce that transfer of ownership contract, because that was the obvious intent of Michael Culligan in signing it, was to transfer the ownership of the policy to Richard McDonald. And it wasn't until after his death, in fact, it was after he told the police that Richard McDonald had a life insurance policy and Megan Hansen was the new beneficiary on the policy. 2 days after he told the police that, he told Protective Life Insurance that, no, we're not going to change the ownership. We're not going to resubmit this form. We're just going to leave it as it is.
Well, and, you know, when the insurance policy is originally taken out, it's to insure the business. Right, and so the business is the beneficiary to begin with. It's a way of financing and a way of providing some kind of security. They paid all the premiums, and I guess, I mean, yes, this is an area where formalities make a difference, I'll just say, but the formality here is, it says on this letter, this is the February 19th letter, the insured was Richard Keith McDonald. The owner was B&K Enterprises. And Crystalline Klein sends this letter back saying, I'll handle your request for service as soon as I receive the properly completed forms. And she never does. The company never does. I mean, your whole theory of this case is, oh, you know, if they'd only realized it wasn't a corporation, maybe they would have changed the ownership. We don't know. It didn't happen.
The fact of the matter is that they would change the ownership if that form was sent to them.
So you believe, but it didn't happen.
Correct. In addition to that, Megan Hansen is the named beneficiary on this policy. So if B&K is ever to receive the proceeds, the court has to equitably reform it in their favor.
If they're going to go into reformation, that change was made by a different bureaucrat at the company and made at the request of somebody with no authority to make it, namely a non-owner of the policy. So if there's any changing that has to be done, that would seem the change to make.
Well, and even if we agree with you and go along with your theory, when we reach the merits of the case about this fraudulent conveyance, why shouldn't the transfer be voided under the Fraudulent Transfer Act, at least to the extent necessary to avoid the creditor's claims, when it's so clear what the intent of this policy was?
Sure. It's our position that the fraudulent conveyance claims the court does not have jurisdiction over, because Robert K. Stoyer, who's the assignee of the creditors of B&K, failed to file a notice of appeal, of cross-appeal, on those claims, and B&K doesn't have standing.
He doesn't have to file a cross-appeal if he likes the result below. You only file a cross-appeal if you're trying to get more or different from what the district court did. And Mr. Stoyer, as far as I'm concerned, is quite happy with what the district court did.
Correct. But the remedy for what Mr. Stoyer would be asking for is a constructive trust in favor of the creditors, which is not the remedy that was imposed by the district court.
There's no need to. Mm-hmm. By giving all the money to B&K, it automatically was going to happen, and the district court addresses that in his order.
But the judgment would still address a different party than it did. The judgment went to B&K, not to Robert Stoyer.
And B&K is paying its creditors. I mean, I don't think Mr. Stoyer has any further interest beyond that of what's left of B&K. It's winding up, right? I mean, or has wound up, aside from whatever debts to creditors are out there. We can ask B&K that. But.
Correct, but the fact of the matter is that there would be a judgment for a different party than the judgment that was entered to the district court. And you have to cross appeal in order to receive judgment for a separate party. It's our position that the transfer of ownership form is a binding contract to transfer the policy from B&K to Richard McDonald. In Wisconsin, contracts to regarding life insurance policies are held to be binding, and courts will enforce them if there is a mistake on the...
If there had been a contract, if there had been a proper form filed that the company had recognized as effective to change ownership, you'd be entirely right. I mean, and maybe Ms. Hansen would get this windfall, though another point I would make is the district court says if we're in the realm of equity, if we're in the realm of reformation, if we're in the realm of other kinds of equitable relief, he actually makes a finding that the equities don't lie with her.
But the standard of review for a declaratory judgment or for summary judgment that requests an equitable remedy is first to determine whether there's a genuine issue of material fact. And it's our position that
the
court...
Let's assume you're right about everything, and then we're back and we're all the way down at the ground about whether the district court abused his discretion in weighing the equities. How could we find that he did?
Because this is a contract case, and the essence of a contract case is more...
You didn't have a contract. It was not accepted.
The contract
did not meet the conditions.
The contract was the initial policy. The intent of the parties...
We know what the initial policy is, but in terms of this change, it was never accepted by the company.
But if you trace back the intent of the parties, the law should entitle Megan Hansen to the proceeds of this policy. The intent of Richard McDonald after...
Of course, you don't have any case law to support this theory.
To support...
Your theory. Your theory that, you know, when it's a situation like this, when it's not accepted, when the conditions were clearly spelled out as to how it should be transferred, I mean, you don't have a case that says that.
The conditions were satisfied for how it should be transferred based on the language of the policy. This was an LLC. It needed one signature. That's exactly what they got. And for Michael Culligan to, after Richard McDonald died, decide to take back that contract, no, we're not going to transfer the policy. He's in breach of that agreement to transfer the policy.
Suppose the company had received this thing signed by Culligan, and they look at it and they say, but he wants to transfer it to Mr. McDonald, and we know, let's just suppose hypothetically, maybe Bauer told them or somebody, that Mr. McDonald has had his problems with honesty and the like, which apparently he did. And so we need to look into this further before we process that form. We want to make sure that there's no fraudulent conveyance going on. We don't want to get swept up in a lot of litigation. We're just going to do a further investigation. Companies can do that, can't they?
But at the time of the signing of that document, Michael Culligan put forward that he was the only person who was available to sign that document.
I'm not talking about that. I'm saying the document itself that was sent by Mr. Culligan proposed, if you will, tried to say, we would like to change the ownership of this policy from B&K to Richard McDonald. Right?
Right.
And suppose, just hypothetically, Mr. Bauer, who seems to have been the agent at the center of a lot of this, had said to...
No relation.
No relation, as far as we know. No relation.
It's gone, actually.
Had said, McDonald is bad news. You know, maybe you better look into this. Don't do it right away. Have a little bit of investigation before you change the ownership.
If the insurance agent had told that to Michael Culligan?
No, had told that to the insurance company. The insurance company gets the letter from Culligan saying transfer it to McDonald. And it comes to the insurance company's attention somehow that there may be a problem with this transfer. So they want to investigate it. That's what I want to know. Because, in other words, you're just assuming it's just a ministerial act. You just change the ownership no matter what. And I'm not sure it's so automatic.
The vice president of policyholder services, who's in charge of that department, stated, yes, this meets the requirements. And regardless, if an investigation did proceed, it dates back to the date that the transfer of ownership document was signed, which is January 31st of 2008.
So in other words, they could have unwound it if they'd found out that McDonald was trying to deprive the creditors of B&K of the proceeds.
They could have unwound it?
No,
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
If ownership had been transferred to McDonald and Protective had looked into the facts of the case, I think what you just told me, if they had found out that McDonald was trying to prevent the creditors from being paid, is that it could have, that the transfer could have been undone and B&K would wind up being the owner again.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
I didn't think that's what you wanted to say.
No, what I'm saying is that regardless of whenever Protective accepts the transfer of ownership form, it is in effect on the date that the form is signed by the parties, by the owner, which would be January 31st of 2008.
Okay. She believes it's automatic.
All right. So you have like about a minute of rebuttal left.
I'll save it for rebuttal.
All right. So Mr. Anderson?
Yes, ma'am. And I'm here on behalf of B&K. The appellant in this case...
Can you tell us what's the status of B&K right now? Is it just kind of a shell that's wrapping up, or did it find a new business life?
It did not find a new business life. It is in receivership in Manitowoc County Circuit Court, and it is not conducting any business at this point. There still are approximately $400,000 and almost $500,000 of debts owed to creditors that fall under the umbrella of the receivership.
So who would get, this was $1 million policy, who's, in your view, entitled to the other $500,000?
I'm not sure that my view is particularly binding on that, since the receiver, Mr. Stoyer, is in control of all of B&K's assets and will be if some assets come into the LLC. My feeling on it is that he would be the distribution would occur pursuant to the receivership statute in Wisconsin, which would go to creditors and then to members' claims, and then I'm assuming that any overage would go to the members based on their contribution.
Now, at the time all of these events happen, was Mr. McDonald in any way still a member of the LLC, or had he severed all relations with it?
His position as manager had been severed after the embezzlement was discovered. Mm-hmm. He was still a member of the LLC.
Still technically a member. Okay.
The appellant, Megan Hansen, has four very large hurdles to overcome here based on Judge Griesbach's decision. You questioned a lot on the policy language and what happened. And you are correct, Judge Griesbach found that under the facts as they occurred, the ownership of the policy had not changed on Protective's books and records, and that is how the policy defines the owner, and therefore, since only the owner could change the beneficiary, the change of the beneficiary from B&K to Megan Hansen was not proper. And Protective, of course, recognized that there was a problem with the beneficiary designation change, which is why the stakeholder lawsuit was started in the first place. So Ms. Hansen must establish that Judge Griesbach committed some kind of legal error in terms of his policy interpretation, and we submit that there certainly was none because the policy language is very clear, and B&K remains to this day the owner of the policy on Protective's books and records.
So I guess her theory is that old equitable maxim, equity regards as done that which should have been done, and had they understood that it was an LLC when Culligan sends the request to change ownership, which might have looked fishy to them anyway, because I guess there's also this McDonald document that comes to change ownership. But anyway, had Culligan sent the single signature, they would have changed it, and you would have been in a very different position.
Had they changed ownership, then we would be arguing that the change of ownership was not valid, A, because of Mr. McDonald's lack of consideration. Appellant's attorney calls this a binding contract. The district court very clearly ruled that there was no consideration paid by McDonald for the policy. There were no negotiations between Culligan and McDonald. There were no promises made. There were no promises passed through the intermediary, Jerry Brown, the insurance agent. There simply was no consideration to support the change of ownership if, in fact, it was construed to be a contract.
So what about this theory, though, that what was happening, that what Culligan was doing was winding up the affairs of B&K, and that just to get something with a fairly tiny cash surrender value, $217 or what it was, something like that, was worth it in and of itself just to avoid the transaction cost of having to deal with it.
But there weren't any transaction costs. There's nothing in the record to establish that. Culligan's testimony was that we were simply going to let it lapse, not pay the premium. There wasn't any administrative expenses, as referred to in Megan Hansen's brief. There simply was just going to be no payment, and the policy would eventually lapse after the grace period expired. That also begs the question of whether Culligan was authorized to give away that policy, which is what he did, and the district court clearly ruled that under the operating agreement and under the Wisconsin LLC statutes, that Mr. Culligan was not authorized to give that policy to McDonald as a member.
I think if there's no consideration, I mean, I think once you get over into gift land, that's pretty easy. I think the question really is, was there some benefit that flowed back to B&K such that one could say this was not a gift?
Well, and certainly Judge Griesbach found that there was not. And we submit that the record clearly establishes that there was not. There was no promise by McDonald to take over the payment of the premium. There was no evidence of any administrative expense savings. The policy would have simply lapsed. So this is what I would consider to be, based on my experience, a fairly unique case of absolutely no consideration and nothing to hang your hat on from a consideration standpoint.
So the policy was paid until March 1st, right?
That's correct. So based for those reasons, we would ask that the court confirm or affirm Judge Griesbach's decision making B&K the beneficiary. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Stoyer?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Robert K. Stoyer. I'm the assignee for the benefit of creditors of B&K. In response,
I'm here to defend the district court's judgment, right?
To put it more figuratively, I think, I virtually jump for joy at the decision. I can't physically do it, but virtually, because it is favorable to me, and it resulted in the proceeds of the policy being available for administration in the receivership or...
What are you going to do with the other half?
Pardon me?
What are you going to do with the rest of the money?
Well, I don't... I'm going to do what the court directs me to do.
Oh. Good answer.
I will make a recommendation as to what I think should be the distribution under the provisions of Chapter 128 of the Wisconsin statutes. I don't hesitate to say that the first priority will be expenses of administration, and I'll ask that they be paid, and I'll ask that the creditors be paid. Actually, before I make that request, I will examine the claims that have been filed, make sure that they are appropriate, but they are all filed under oath, and I assume that will be the case. So I'm here in support of the judgment, and I'm here because in the event the court should somehow decide that the judgment needs further review or consideration, what should occur is it should be either the issue that has been deferred, that was regarded as moot and denied, as to the fraudulent transfer issue, can be decided by this court on the facts that are here, or the case would be remanded for the determination of that issue. I think it is very clear that whether or not there was a legal consideration, there was no reasonably equivalent value for the transfer of the policy.
Could I just interrupt and say, under Wisconsin law, anything at the moment that goes to B&K just flows right through to you as the receiver in your fiduciary capacity?
Yes. I mean, it will go into my account, and I will then ask the court for authority as to how to distribute the money from the account.
I mean, obviously, as a fiduciary.
It's no different from the bankruptcy provisions, but in effect.
So there really, at some level, isn't a big difference between you and B&K at this point.
I've been assigned, under the statute, I not only get all of B&K's property to administer, but I have the strong arm powers of a receiver, and I have the ability to pursue the fraudulent transfer action.
That's what you, should there be need for it, that's what you're asking us for.
That's correct. And so for those reasons, I would request that the decision below be affirmed, that we don't have to consider these other issues, but if we do, that they be decided favorably to the creditors of B&K, whose interests should be honored and they should be paid prior to any other distribution. Thank you.
All right, thank you. You had just about a minute, Spock Huber, so you'll have to be quick.
I just want to talk about the consideration involved here. It's our position that there was consideration for the transfer of the policy. Number one, the transfer of ownership form specifically states that the transfer is for consideration, receipt of which is hereby acknowledged. That should create a presumption that there was consideration for the transfer of the policy. At least there is a genuine issue of material fact as to whether there was consideration involved here. In addition, Culligan testified that he didn't know much about this policy at all. He would have had to do something. There's no way he would just pick up the policy, open it up, look at it, ask the other members what he should do with it, receive notices in the mail from the insurance company, open them, finding out that the policy was going to lapse. There was consideration involved, and it's at the time of the transfer. So the consideration is for something that was worth $217.50. We're not talking about consideration for $1 million. And that's the same standard for the fraudulent conveyance statute. Here.
Okay, we will. I think we have your point from your brief. Thank you very much. Thanks to both or all counsel. We will take the case under advisement.